for the day about the significance of the way in which we take hold of certain elements or facets of experience of life and invest in them, the somehow capacity to fulfill our life, or attribute to them the capacity to be an obstacle to that fulfillment. And this is really the underlying dynamic around which attachment, in the sense of clinging, as we understand it in the Buddha's teaching, operates. And so I've mentioned the attachment to sense pleasure, the way in which we look for that fulfillment and stimulation, enjoyment, entertainment in that way. The attachment to rites and rituals and the sense of something that's going to do it for me. And the attachment to views and opinions, the way in which we take positions or perspectives in such a way as to use them to create security for ourselves. And the fourth realm of craving and clinging, the fourth great attachment that the Buddha spoke about, is the attachment to self and to doctrines of self. It's kind of late in the day to pick up that whole topic, and it's intentional that I'm not intending to try and do a detailed exposition of that territory, because it's there's quite a lot there. But the basic area of attachment is, well, there's really two primary ways to be looking at this, to seeing the ways in which we both relate to what we call ourself, in terms of how we conceive of, how we define, and how we believe, or what beliefs we hold about who and what we are. And this is really where a lot of our attention and energy goes. A lot of our focus and thinking, as one student, I was just reading on the train up, a student of mine in America, was just writing me a brief email what she was noticing in her practice and observing that she, until recently, had thought she'd thought about all sorts of different things while she was busy lost in thinking, and she's recently discovered that mostly she's thinking about what people think of her. And I think that's a probably accurate reflection of something that many of us spend a lot of time thinking about, what people think of us and the way in which we invest in the way we are perceived, the way we are conceived. And interestingly, with regard to that, a teacher whose name I don't think I ever knew once observed, I heard it quoted, that we would spend a lot less time worrying about what other people thought of us if we knew how little time they spent doing it. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because if we look at our own minds, we see that mostly we're actually thinking about ourselves, and actually so is everybody else. They're not so much thinking about us in the way we might sometimes imagine or fear or hope. So there's this way in which we conceive ourselves based on the way our history, our life, our experience has unfolded, and we tend to think in terms of I am or I have this, I am like this, I'm not like that, I have this, I don't have that. Stories or ways of perceiving that might accurately reflect our predominant experience, but don't necessarily, because of the way when we attach them they become a fixity, they don't allow for the fluidity and for the inconstancy of any positioning. So we might experience ourselves as, you know, quite often struggling, and we think, you know, I'm someone who struggles a lot, and I've always been struggling. Actually, life's been a struggle. See, when I look at it, my parents' life was pretty bad as well, and theirs. So probably my kids, yeah. You know, we kind of create this solid continuity of struggling. And sometimes it arises out of just a simple experience of struggling with our meditation, and then we realize, I'm struggling, oh, it's always like this. We tell a story, we make it fixed and solid, and it might accurately recognize that sometimes we struggle. Yeah, that's okay. That's not attachment to views of self. Sometimes struggling happens, sure. But we tend to make it solid in a way of like, it's always like this, or this is really who I am. And so it becomes something defining. And then actually it becomes weighty and problematic. So we could equally, you know, have some view of ourselves that I'm someone who doesn't struggle. And, you know, I'm just sort of flowing along and it's all easy and nice. And equally we can make that into something fixed and absolute. And a little bit like the views, in a way, views of self are a specific category within our attachment to views in general. And we have both views of ourself, and the limiting factor about them is they don't allow for, if I'm someone who struggles, they don't allow for the fact that I might actually be finding some degree of ease at some point. And because I'm someone who struggles, I think something's gone wrong here, and I'll go and look for something to struggle with. And I'll find it, for sure. There'll be something out there to struggle with. And so the definition of self becomes self-confirming in that way. Or if I'm someone who doesn't struggle, and things are pretty easy and always go well for me, if that's my self-view, then when something doesn't actually work out okay, it's really hard to handle and can be quite destabilizing. Not so much because the difficult thing is difficult, but because it's shaking the certainty of the identity. And so in the practice, one is asked to reflect on and to notice those places where we hold or take a position in an absolute way that I am like this or I'm not like that. So there's views about self, we could say, in that regard. And then there's also, as a version of views and opinions, and there's also what we could say opinions about the nature of self in general. That's a little bit what I touched on before. But it can be about oneself or all selves that, you know, and the Buddha spoke a lot about this, that, you know, well, there isn't any such thing as self. That's an idea. The Buddha's pointed out that there's no such thing as self, so all those people who think they have a self, they're completely deluded. Whereas prior to that, of course, one really did think one had a self. And that's equally just another view. The Buddha is inviting us in this context to investigate what happens if I relate to experience in these terms. If I relate to it from the point of view of self, and this is me or this is mine, or this is not me or not mine, because self always has an inclusive and an exclusive element. Like, it can't operate without that something included within and something separated out of, or else it just doesn't make sense. If it's everything included in, then we wouldn't call it self. It wouldn't make sense. And if there's nothing included in it, well, what to say? It's always a partial inclusion in any sense of self. Yeah, we include this, but not that. It's the only way it works. And so noticing what the effect of that is. Essentially, it has the effect of creating limitation and separation. By definition, that's what it is. And when the Buddha talked about understanding the teaching of not self, one could equally see that what's being pointed to is an understanding of non-separateness, of non-separating, that there's a dividing and separating function that takes place in the making of self. And taking a position on whether self exists or does not exist is actually something the Buddha didn't do. This is contrary to what one can hear quite often in Buddha's teaching, where people say the Buddha said there's no self. And he didn't, actually. He said that the different experiences that arise, which we habitually take to be self, If we take them to be what we are, to be self, we suffer as a result. He didn't say that they... He didn't say or make any metaphysical statement of position. And it's very interesting because what that asks us to do is again stay in that place of being unable to locate or land in the I do exist or I don't exist. Either of which would make, you know, if I knew one or the other, it would make things a bit easier. The sense of self, existent or non-existent. The way in which the perception of self arises is, of course, often distorted and inaccurate. And just reflecting on the way that we think of ourself in terms of absolutes, like it's always or never, when much more accurately we would reflect our experience by sometimes it's like this and sometimes it's not. Sometimes I show up like this and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I seem to know how to meditate and other times I don't appear to have a clue. Rather than I can do it or I can't do it. But it's really hard for us to keep it that open. And that really that's the point of the way in which I'm wanting to refer to this territory at the moment, rather than trying to lay that whole doctrine or teaching out. It's very hard not to land in a position that says I am or I am not this. I'm not this body or I am this body. I'm not this mind or I am this mind. There is a self or there isn't a self. What would happen if we weren't taking either of those positions in any of those pairs, in any of those dichotomies? If we weren't attaching to, and it's interesting in the original, or the modern translations of the best version we have of the original teaching, the way the Buddha frames it, and for anyone who's interested, it's the it's number 11, is it? Let me just see it's number 11 in the Majjhima Nikaya, MN 11 is the citation, the Kula Siha Nanda Sutta, the shorter discourse on the lion's roar, if you want all that kind of information. But the way he describes, the way the Buddha describes is clinging to a doctrine of self, clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, they translate it here, rather than rites and rituals, rules and observances, and clinging to a doctrine of self. It's like something in us really wants to constellate our world around a central point which is essentially always going to come down to some sense or view or position around self. And it has the effect of locating us in a way which is very reassuring but ultimately profoundly limiting. Because we're locating within a construct. And a construct is by definition limited and ultimately subject to deconstruction. So in terms of practicing and working with this particular teaching, to look and notice where thoughts arise or positions, perspectives, views arise around what we call or imagine or believe or know to be self. And not to negate them and say, no, it's not like that, there isn't a self, or I'm not this body, or I am, not getting into an argument about the positions, but noticing the tendency to position oneself itself. That's actually where the attachment functions. It's in that urge to position oneself and to locate oneself around it. And that... And together with the other three, this, in relationship to the sense of self, this is the most fundamental way in which what I described earlier, that process of attachment, locks us into a certain orientation to life, in which we're looking, in a way, at life as something other, which may have the opportunity to, or the capacity to satisfy us, or not, depending on whether we organize it as we hope or imagine it should be. But that orientation actually the sense of self and the referring to a position, a location, a view, a doctrine in an absolute way is that the fundamental, in a way, keystone or locking piece in what makes it so hard to actually release the fixity of orientation to life in that way. To, as I described earlier, the shift that the Buddha's teachings are pointing to is not born of going somewhere else or changing the nature of our experience or what is happening in that experience. It's actually an, as I said, 180 degrees reorientation within it in a way that we can only really come to understand by consciously working on the releasing of where we hold. Without knowing, as we do that, where we will find ourselves or where we will find what's happening in that reorienting. A little bit like the story of me on the hill, having given up believing that it's here, only freed me up to look elsewhere. It did not in itself show me where to go. And I could have equally decided, instead of going, you know, I basically said to myself, okay, about 30 degrees clockwise from where I think it is, I'll go down there. And if I don't find it down there, I'll come back up and I'll go another 30 degrees. And I'll just keep doing that until I've gone down every side of this hill that I can find. Now, I could have started off by going 30 degrees anti-clockwise. And then I would have taken a lot longer to find the path. I'd have gone all the way around it. But it would have still been possible to do that. And really, that's the invitation that's here in terms of the practice and the teaching. And so I think I'll end it there in terms of that particular piece. There's more that could be said and questions that could be asked, which I would like to leave a little bit of time for.